of two eyes, huh? Do you understand the game a bit? Yeah, have a look.
I'm not saying anything to you in particular because I know you're not too accurate with your reporting.
That's what you paid for.
So you're saying I should resign? So you're saying I should resign?
I think
that's your opinion.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's my
opinion.
Okay, fine. Are you going to resign then?
No, of course I'm not going to resign.
I simplify things next time.
Wes, welcome back to the National Curriculum. We are back with a second episode. I too am surprised. I cannot believe that Mickey Mouse didn't appear with a baseball bat outside my house after our first episode and told me to cut this shit out. No, it is the National Curriculum. We are back again, and it's a pretty quiet day, really. I'm not sure. No, it's a big day. It is, well, it's a momentous day. The grand final deal, it is dead. The grand final deal is dead. Long live the Unite round. And to go over that and a number of other big issues in Australian football, including the fact that, you know, the A-League men, it's actually back this weekend as well. I too am surprised. I'd completely forgotten about it in the excitement of the A-League women's record-setting round. It is the Australian Associated Press's The Far Post podcast's own. We'll give plenty of props to that one because it too is part of the ESPN family sipping on that ESPN juice. It is Anna Harrington Harrow. Thank you ever so much for putting up with my inanity here on a Wednesday morning and joining me for a chat.
Thank you. And putting up with your inanity is just a standard weekday or weekend day for me come football season, right? So
it pretty much. In fact,
on air this time.
Yeah, you and I are often the only two journos at events here in Melbourne, and I am increasingly thinking it's because none of the others want to have to put up with my shit. But yes, it is, well, it's a mammoth day. You can't go about, you can't, you know, talk about anything else. But the grand final deal is dead, announced at 9 a.m. on Wednesday morning. The controversial plan to stage grand finals in Sydney for this season and the next, at least, it has been scrapped. And moving forward, it will immediately be replaced by a Unite round concept, the first of which will be taking place from January 12 to 14 early next year, both men's and women's games all heading to Sydney over the course of 3 days at the Sydney Football Stadium, Leichhardt Oval and Parramatta Stadium. I won't call them their sponsored names because they don't pay me any money, but Harrow, this is a massive win, isn't it?
Huge. I mean, it's the logical step for the APL and co to take. I mean, credit to all parties involved, which is obviously your destination, New South Wales, and that as well, for taking the hit. They got, let's be honest, everyone got lucky in the sense that they had Sydney FC make the women's grand final and Central Coast make the men's grand final last year. Had it been, say, I don't know, Melbourne City v Adelaide United, two non-New South Wales teams, they could have well been disasters, right? So I think everyone took what they got out of it, changed it, moved on, and hopefully this can go some way back to not necessarily winning back all the trust, but at least somewhat repairing, starting to repair some of the trust that were sort of burned, the bridges that were burned between fans and the league's governing body at least. So logical move, had to be done. And to be, let's be honest, the Unite round, Gather round, Magic round, depending on your code of choice, whatever you like to call it, all the games in the one city, it's a much better outcome, right? And you'd think it's actually a better situation than a grand final where you're only going to have maybe one or two sets of fans travel. If you get people to optimise it, it's in school holidays, it's in the middle of summer, it should be a good opportunity to get people up. And I like that there's a mixture of venues as well. It had to be done, right? Like there was no way that grand final situation could happen again.
No, you're right. Absolutely. I mean, you are right in a sense. You can't unfire the gun, so to speak. The genie cannot get put back in the bottle. We have had 10 months of, well, ill feeling and disappointment and a lack of trust between fans and the leagues. And this decision won't completely repair that. But it's just been remarkable just seeing the torrent of, it's been joy, an explosion of excitement surrounding this announcement that has come out of this. And it will go a long way, I think, to especially shifting the conversation around the A-League men in particular. I think it was really noticeable that heading into this season, there was a ton of positive sentiment and, you know, excitement and anticipation surrounding the A-League women competition. Off the back of the Women's World Cup, everybody was really rooting for it. They wanted it to succeed, and we saw record crowds across the first week of the season. but none of that sentiment really existed for the A-League men. There was excitement, inevitably, with the start of new season because fans still love their clubs, but that lack of trust, that, I guess, worn down sense of, oh, what's coming next with the league itself had really sapped a lot of energy out of the room. And now, on announcing it on the eve of the season, it's a big win as well. This wouldn't have hit, I don't think, quite the same way if we were doing this after round one. But it has the potential to, like, give a real boost heading into round one. I mean, I immediately saw Melbourne City tweet out a video talking about how good Amy Park. So that's
the right to do so. Yeah. As proud Victorian. But Joey, it's a shot in the arm, right? But the thing they did right with this announcement, as opposed to the grand final decision last year, was it got put out there. You know, my colleague and friend of this pod, George Clark, wrote this story a while back saying that this is what they were considering, ditching the grand final relocation in favour of what is now known as a Unite round. And the feedback was positive. You throw the idea out there, or it gets out there, no matter what way it gets out, right? And it got a really positive reception. So people were anticipating this. This is what they wanted. They're excited, as opposed to the grand final one, which just landed and everyone was pissed off, right? So it's been done the right way. One thing I would be interested to see is how Leichhardt Oval stands up in terms of, I know there's quite a few A-League women games there. I think there's A-League men fixture there. It's obviously
No A-League men's fixture. So four.
Apologies. I was reading the fixture wrong then. But they have those A-League women fixtures there. How that stands up, that'll be interesting to see. But, yeah, I mean, it's clearly the right decision, right? It just had to be done. I'm not sure what this will mean financially. I know with the men's league, it is an extra round on the calendar. It doesn't change the women's season. But I think just for overall goodwill and starting to mend those barriers. And it's a good time to do it as well, because I think it will be during that sort of, we know the A-League isn't taking international breaks, but with the Asian Cup campaign sort of kicking off, make it a real sort of football weekend and try and make the most of it.
Well, they are going to put on a live site for the India game afterwards. Socceroos versus India, there'll be a live site at Moore Park. And, I mean, some commiserations to Western United, given that because the A-League women aren't adding around, they lose another home game to Sydney FC after last year's grand final. But I think the decision was just made. Like, they could, obviously they were able to add another round for the men's. They couldn't do so for the women's. But when they were weighing up the pros and cons of just ripping the Band-Aid off and doing it this year, they sort of had to do it.
And I'm sure we'll speak to Western United over this next two days. And would it surprise you, Joey, if some sort of deal gets struck to do a flipping of home games to make sure this is equitable? I wouldn't be shocked by that, to be honest. They haven't played each other yet. So with a home and away season, to me, it would make sense to do that. We'll see.
Yeah. And it really gives the league, I think, a position to... I mean, this in and of itself is a great move, but I think not only is this going to give a boost to fan sentiment around the league, it's going to enable the A-Leagues to, I guess, in a way, get credit or actually work towards other initiatives a lot easier now. One of the things that I really noticed ever since the grand final deal was announced was that the league wasn't being given an inch. It wasn't being given the benefit of the doubt. It wasn't being given credit for anything. So even when they did good stuff, even when they did the right thing, there was an almost loathing amongst fans to actually give them any credit. And anything that previously, you know, be it a typo on a keep-up post to maybe a misquote from someone or somebody says something.
They'd get hammered, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they'd get absolutely hammered for it because there was just no appetite to give them any credit. Maybe now this is the process wherein some of that relationship starts to be being repaired as well, so to speak. And not for nothing, also, it's gonna, like as you said, it's gonna be an awesome weekend now. Like, this is what it should have always been. Like, you'll get back-to-back-to-back games, it'll be a great weekend, you'll get everybody in from around the country. It's gonna be a lot of fun. And it's going to give a massive shot in the arm to the league. It's really like they don't get complete credit in my book because they're fixing something they broke.
That they broke themselves, right?
Yeah. You can't give them 100% credit for it, but you do have to acknowledge that all parties came together and fixed it.
Well, that's the thing. They could have doubled down, right? They could have gone, actually, no, this is a three-year deal. As that was the messaging that was coming out last year around the ground. This is a great success and everyone loves it. And that clearly wasn't the case, right? So to clearly take the feedback on board, all parties are got involved. And this is also a shot in the arm the league needed, because we're going to see that we've lost some big-name stars. You know, there's Craig Gilbert, Jason Cummings, Sammy Silvera, the, you know, players that have taken moves overseas, be it for the cash, be it for, you know, to progress their careers. And it, the league is going to need, one, some young players to, we've lost a Geordie Boss as well, for example, some young players to step up and become the faces of this league. But it is going to need to go with that fan buy-in, right? That's, it's going to need some good crowds. And we've heard some talk about the active situation at Melbourne Victory and the old North Terrace looking like they're wanting to get back involved. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this all takes off. And I think this was a really important step in that regard. I'm sure Melbourne City is sitting back doing a bit of a, oh, if only. Western United, A-League women, right? Like, but at the end of the day, it happened. It's done.
From a competitive standpoint, it also absolutely had to happen, because you had a situation last year wherein two Melbourne sides, one hosting rights to their respective grand finals, had to travel to New South Wales to take on New South Wales-based teams in the final, and they lost by a combined score of 10-1.
And let's not forget the poor Melbourne-based journos who spent 2 weekends in Sydney.
And then the Women's World Cup as well. It was just torturous.
We don't need that.
No. One thing I am going to be interested, though, is obviously the Festival of Football concept copped a lot of stick and deserved, because it was a fine weekend in of itself, but it didn't make anybody forget. It didn't justify losing hosting rights from previous systems. But a lot of that Festival of Football was surrounded on, it didn't work out with Bayern Munich, but a lot of it centered upon bringing in touring sides at that time of year and playing those games around the same times as the grand final in the same city. Now, we know touring sides probably still on the cards as part of the league's strategy. They're going to shift towards more player development focus, less aging marquees, and they're going to rely on touring sides for their sugar hits. Where do the touring sides sit now? We know as part of the deal with Destination New South Wales, those touring sides probably going to end up in Sydney. Now you're sort of a situation similar to the All-Star versus Barcelona game, where we had the All-Star game in Sydney and then the grand final between City and Western United was played in Melbourne. Is that going to be the scenario going forward? I'm going to be really, do we now try to book these touring sides for two games? One game in Sydney and then another game in wherever's hosting the men's or women's grand final. If you've got,
I think it depends who's paying the cash, right? Like if it's a New South Wales government thing, they're paying up for it, it'll be there. And that worked really well with the Barcelona one, right? So that's a bit of a TBC.
Well, we've probably exhausted grand final chat. But there is some other news, though. It's remarkable, Harrow. There's actually a bunch of good news around the A-Leagues at the moment. I'm not sure what to do with myself. Perth Glory have a new ownership group, and the Auckland expansion license has been announced as well. We'll go to Auckland first before moving on to the Glory. But, well, it looks like the New Zealand Knights are going to get the brand, or at least the Knights portion of the brand, is coming back. The owner of the Vegas Golden Knights, the Black Knight Football Group, has been tapped as the preferred owner. His name's Bob something or other. He's a billionaire, American billionaire. I'm being caught very much off the footing here. But Harrow, what was your announcement to that as I look up his name?
It was interesting seeing a bit of a mixed reaction to the Knights branding. I must admit, like, New Zealand Knights is one of my real weak spots when it comes to doing the A-League grid game. That and the North Queensland Fury and Gold Coast United. But you know what? We learn and we grow, and I've gotten much better, and you always know when you can use Jeremy Brockie as an answer for things. It was important, right? Like, the expansion had been floated. They talked about wanting to have Auckland, wanting to have Canberra, and we know that the getting the finances up is the major part of getting these deals done. So I would imagine from an excitement point of view, it's it's fantastic that you've got someone. I haven't looked a heap into this, to be honest. This is more a Ben McKay across the ditch effort for in terms of AAP. But it's exciting to see that they've got someone in place. They've got a preferred owner. It's willing to stump up the cash. I think it's exciting in terms of the prospect of is it a derby when you've got the two different cities? I don't know. But clearly there's going to be a rivalry.
It's a rivalry. Exactly.
It's a rivalry. It's not such a distant derby, at least. I think that's going to be important in terms of football in New Zealand, since seeing more players come through. I think it will obviously take a little while in terms of the A-League women's, because we saw the Phoenix have taken a bit of time to get up and going, but they were pretty exciting in round one, to be honest, this season. I think it's a positive development. It'll be interesting to see how quickly Canberra can sort of follow suit. It seems like that's taking that bit longer. But Auckland, it seems like it's happening pretty quickly. But again, the key will be for them to do it right. Yeah, like you don't want, you know, as much as Western United have had some stuff on field and MacArthur have had some flashes, like off field, they've really struggled in terms of traction, in terms of fans. So what we need to see is that they're going to pull in crowds and make it an exciting prospect. Be interesting for your Perth Glories and co having to do multiple trips, extensive trips to New Zealand. But, yeah, I mean, we knew this was coming. So it's good to see that there's some finances behind it.
Yeah, and I've looked at it. It's American billionaire Bill Foley, who is the money man, owner of Premier League side Bournemouth, as well as the Vegas Golden Knights. And one of the big things looking at him coming in, he also does have extensive business ties to New Zealand. So that's a plus as well. As I think I can hear Vincho, the Black Lab.
Stunning himself, and now he's come in to see what's up.
See, I had Soot, the people's cat, stalking around before, but she's now left as well. But yeah, obviously he has the footballing group. He's also an owner of French side Laurent in I think they're a league side. And well, we know the APL were actually in the market for multi-club networks as part of these expansion efforts, so they appear to have ticked off that box. But he does have extensive business ties to New Zealand as well, so there is an existing buy-in to the region and a commitment. He's not just asked for a license and, you know, been plonked in New Zealand. This is actually a deal that makes sense for him, I guess. For me, my colours have long been nailed to the mast that, you know, my preferred method of expansion was always just create a national second division and then promote winners of that to expand and bring it in that way. But if you are going to do it the way that the A-Leagues aren't doing it, they've gone out and done a whole bunch of research to find the right, very MLS style. They've gone out and identified their preferred markets and then gone out and tried to find preferred bidders, and bring in multi-club networks and that sort of things and do the groundwork on stadiums and that. It seems to have gone very well in Auckland. And I know, obviously, the new commissioner, Nick Garcia, has been at the forefront of doing that, at the forefront for a lot of things, actually. It feels like Nick Garcia has supplanted Danny Townsend as sort of the executive face of the A-Leagues. But this seems to be one of the major ticks on his burgeoning tenure as A-League's commissioner. And it does be going well. It does make you wonder, though, what the go is with Canberra, because Danny Townsend, in an interview with me, did say, well, he sort of intimated that announcements on Auckland and Canberra were coming in a manner that suggested that they would be, if not simultaneous, very close together. And we haven't heard much from Canberra. And the question
not
for
much
me
at
would
all,
be,
right?
Yeah. And the question for me would be just how late you can actually leave proceedings before it gets too late to bring Canberra in for 2024-25. Admittedly, because that Canberran license is going to absorb the Canberra United license and ostensibly think the player contracts and all of that from it, they probably don't have to do much work in building the women's team, but there's still going to be work to do on that front, branding, building a men's team, building infrastructure. So it is getting, I guess, maybe into squeaky bum time on that front.
And whether they do just decide to take the hit and stagger it like what they did with Western and MacArthur, right? And yeah, pretty clearly it's going to have to absorb Canberra United, and they'll be working around that, how they take it. I think Canberra football will be pretty happy to not let them go, because obviously they've been a huge part of it for a long time, but running a professional top-tier football club is something that a federation the State Federation shouldn't have to juggle at this point in time. Like, that's the sort of business model we saw 10 plus years ago now, right? So it's clearly going to have to get a shuffle along. And sometimes these things also depend on budget announcements and those sort of things as well, right? So a lot of things can hinge on when a government decides, or a state government or a federal government decides, now's a good time to cash in this little announcement that we've been hanging on.
Absolutely. And the other announcement was that Melbourne-based property tycoon Robert Bridge, maybe he wants to sell me a bridge, has won the race to buy Perth Glory after Tony Sage was forced to hand back the license and the club went into receivership. And this has all taken place very quickly, Harrow, obviously in contrast to something like the Newcastle Jets, who have been on the market since I was a wee young lad. But it probably, in my estimation, speaks to the fact that it was receivers that were trying to sell this license rather than the A-League's clubs. Of course, numerous other factors involved as well. West Australia, capital city of out there, not a lot of competition versus Newcastle, small market, very crowded market. But really, because it was receivers, it was just in their best interest to sell as quickly as possible within parameters of finding a good owner, obviously. And that's what we've seen versus the Jets, who are being sold by A-League's clubs, which obviously don't want to take too much of a bath on maintaining the Jets over these past few years and are holding out for a decent price.
Well, the thing is with the Jets, it just needs to get done, right? Like,
yeah, desperately.
The amount of press conferences we were in with former coach Arthur Pappas, where it was just like, the best signing we can make over the offseason is a new owner. They need certainty. Club needs certainty. Players need certainty, stability. And it's great for Perth that that has actually been able to get done. As much as you say, like, it's receivers just want to get the deal done, I think it gives everyone, we know that they've just on the men's side, Alan Stadler's just taken over as head coach, and it seems like there's been a good transformation in terms of on-field stuff, based on pre-season form at least. And the women's team have got off to a really good start under Alex Parker this season. And for all the players and staff and everyone involved there, you just need that level of stability and trust. And hopefully this is the start of something new for the Glory after a pretty turbulent few years, right? You can only enter this era with a little bit of optimism. I know it's part of our nature as Australian football followers to have pessimism, but it's good to see that this has got done. They enter the season without uncertainty. They know who's paying the bills, who's paying the wages. So, yeah, we'll see how this one plays out. But, yeah, on the face of things, it's exciting. So I'm sure if there is anything to come up, Soccer Twitter will uncover pretty soon. But, yeah, I think it just makes the situation with the Jets even more stark, right, Joey? But it's just been dragging on for some time. And I know they want to find the ideal buyer, but, for the city of Newcastle, for a club that, it's a shame, like a few years ago, 2017-18, right? Around that period, you had the men's team make the grand final, you had the women's team make finals, and it's not really been any or many high points since that point, and that's, you know, 5 going on 6 years now. So hopefully we can see some sort of resolution there soon.
Well, I mean, yeah, not to belabor the point, but this does speak to, I guess, one of the problems with current A-League's model, where it is a closed league based on licenses. You've got a location there. The Jets aren't in a position where they can just drop down, you know, a league, be relegated, regather and come back up again. They just need to exist because the league needs a license there. They're trying to sell it. They're trying to make a profit. So we go through this kind of situation there. It's just sort of the reality that the league has imposed on itself with its operating model, and it's leaving the Jets, and particularly the Jets fans, as well as the staff and players and everybody involved in that organization, in a bit of limbo. But Glory, pleasingly, it looks like they're no staff or players or anything will lose their jobs as a result of this takeover. It looks like it's just going to be a simple transition on that front, which is good to see. And hopefully this new consortium committed to the West, developing talent, developing facilities. And because the Glory, there should be a team that's been more successful than they are. You look at the success they had in the NSL days compared to the A-League. you know, haven't actually won a championship, you know, had some success under Tony Popovich recently, but that went by the by. So one would hope that this is a new era. But we will move on and we can talk about, well, developments from not just this morning, but also across the weekends. The Socceroos were in action, 1-1, lost one, securing a 2-0 win over New Zealand this morning. Should have been 3-0, but George Clark boy Brandon Burrow missed an open goal from just a few yards out in the 85th minute to spur that chance. And that came after a 1-0 defeat against England a few days prior. And I guess one of the biggest, most interesting points for me, Harrow, was just really sort of like how the New Zealand game can almost be seen as a demarcation point for the Socceroos. We look at them thus far in 2023, Ecuador series notwithstanding, most recently they've played Argentina, Mexico, and now England. Three teams where they came in as the underdog, they were able to sit back, be very physical, play on the counter, play the way that Graham Arnold wants them to play, how we saw them begin to play at the World Cup when they shocked Manny by reaching the round 16. But now, in the coming windows there, they got Bangladesh after they beat the Maldives in a playoff, and Palestine in November and World Cup qualifying. Then they've got Syria, India, and Uzbekistan in the Asian Cup. These are all games where the Socceroos are going to have the ball, they're going to be expected to win, and they'll likely have to break down in better defences. So I sort of see this New Zealand game where we began to see that, where we saw the Socceroos as favourites, where they needed to create things as the start of this new era for the team, and the start of what is going to be a critical point for Graham Arnold, because short of disaster, they're not going to lose these games, but we will need to see growth and to the growth in their ability to break down in better defenses, because people forget, you know, it's been lost in all the excitement and success, but Graham Arnold came very close to being sacked during the last cycle. The Federation was leaking against him because of the Socceroos' inability to break down defences. They were playing terribly against teams that would sit back in a low block, and we haven't really seen how they've developed that ability over the past two years thus far.
Well, I think when you look at the selection today, there's a couple of big factors, right? One, Mats Maloro, back in form at club level, even back in the Socceroos. You look at the league. I actually thought the main talking point from this morning, Joey, was how's the audacity of Harry Sutter claiming that goal this morning? Like, Mitch Duke has his lovely acrobatic finish. At most, it's glanced off Sutter. And to be honest, I think this is a silly thing in the first place, that if it were an opposition player and it takes the deflection, it's a goal's awarded to the attacker. But if it takes a silly deflection off your own teammate, they can get awarded the goal. Like, that's a silly little, like, niche in the first place. And the FA have since confirmed the referee, the match officials awarded the goal to Duke in the end. But Big Harry, man, you get enough goals as it is. I don't think you need to be claiming them off your hungry strikers. Pretty funny. But I think justice was served in the end. But what I was going to say, I digress, let's come back out again. And he was so influential today, right? Like, the difference in styles when you've got a player like that. And I think that's what they've been crying out for, right? We know that. We saw glimpses of that in the last World Cup qualifying. Remember Tom Rogic when he went nuts against Vietnam in Melbourne, and then obviously we didn't see him again for various reasons, and he's since retired. That's the sort of player they missed. And I liked the intent of the starting 11 that Graham Arnold picked. I quite liked testing out, playing Aziz Bajic and Jordy Voss, and we know what Jordy Voss can bring. He's very good one-on-one. He's very exciting. I would have probably liked to have seen him finish the game at left back just – that's what I would like to see.
Because he's a left back.
But we know he can play on the wing, right? Yeah. We like the idea of testing them both out together, because they obviously provide something different. And I think they were trying to look for some solutions to do that. It wasn't a purely defensive setup. There was a lot of good attacking, creative players involved. Martin Boyle, I think his return to the Socceroos has been really pleasing, like, considering what he's been through. Hopefully he's actually right for this Asian Cup after such a rough run. But yeah, I mean, you can't really disagree with how it played out this morning. Obviously the Socceroos dominated possession. They found a way to win. And I think that was an important one. As you say, like, they're going to be playing teams that will probably sit back, that will probably deploy a low block, and it's going to be about working their way through that. And I know one of the goals was from a set piece, and New Zealand will be watching the replay of that Jackson Irvine inexplicably defended goal for ages. But the way that the first goal was created, you mentioned the Borrello chance as well, was really pleasing, really exciting, like, you know, to be able to get those ones from open play. So I think that was important. I know the England game is a few days gone. I think they'd have been pretty disappointed with the way they conceded that goal in that one.
Yeah. Probably also worth noting, nobody would be surprised if Harry Soutar gets a hat-trick against both Bangladesh and Palestine from set pieces. I mean, we saw it against Nepal. So, like, Harry...
Well, exactly.
You will fill your boots, Harry. You don't need to steal it off Mitch.
No. The strikes will be hungry. There was a little bit of news to come out this morning. Credit to my colleague, Glenn Moore, Joey, that Graham Allen's asked Anthony Albanese to step in to help find the right venue for the Socceroos game against Palestine. But he's also noted potentially against Lebanon.
Algeria.
Been a report. Algeria said, we're going to host Palestine's games, to which Arnie said, don't understand that because you meant to play inside your own confederation. Yeah. So his point was basically like when Japan got drawn against North Korea in qualifying, the prime minister stepped up and said, we're not going to go and play in North Korea, like sort this shit out, basically. So, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the Socceroos boss appealing to government to make sure this happens. And I'm sure it will all get sorted out. And let's be honest, with Palestine, there's bigger things than football at play. So
absolutely.
Yes.
I would imagine, like, if that game can't take place in Algeria, I imagine Doha or Abu Dhabi would.
Yeah, it'll be somewhere in the Middle East, you'd think.
They will find
a venue at the end of the day.
One thing I wanted to add, particularly around today, but also the England game, really, I think Connor Metcalf impressed me across both of these games. He's been really good. There was one particular exchange he had with Masa Luongo where he found Masa Luongo, darted to the top of the box. Luongo then fed him. He turned and had a shot that in the end went over the bar. But that was one of the things I really saw positive signs there. And of course, it was also Metcalf's back heel that sprung Luongo into the penalty area in the lead into the first goal. And then Luongo back to Metcalf across to Lewis Miller for the cross. But
Lewis Miller looked really good, didn't he?
It was maybe perplexing that he only got 45 minutes, albeit maybe Arnie just wanted to see Ryan Strain against like-for-like opposition so he could judge things with Nathaniel Atkinson out with ligament injuries in his ankle. But for me, it's increasingly, you're looking at it now and you've got Connor Metcalf and Riley McGree, very similar players. It really is becoming a logjam in there. But it almost feels like you can't leave Connor Metcalf out the way that he's playing.
No. And Arnie said as well, I think it was in the pre-series presser, people can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure you will, dear listeners, that Metcalf is looking faster, he's looking stronger. Like he's playing week in, week out now in Germany. You can see him improving. I think it can only help him that he's playing alongside Jackson Irvine so much. But by the same token, it's great that he can, you know, do well today when everyone started on the bench, right? So it's really exciting. And I think what we're seeing now at Socceroos level is what we saw when he was playing really well at Melbourne City, right, Joey? That he was great at those late-timed runs into the boxes. He was a great link between attack and midfield. He had that confidence, a little bit of a strut about the way he played. He'd try on shots from different spots. He'd combine. And I love, for me, we talked about Masa Luongo before, but the fact that he's combined so well with Luongo and they would have ever played together, right? So it's a really exciting proposition to be able to play so well with such a smart player. And surely Luongo's underlined his name as someone that you have to be bringing into these World Cup qualifiers now, someone that you've got to be looking at Asian Cups, because he is that type of player that when things are going to get a little bit testy, and this is maybe not so much the World Cup qualifiers, but come Asian Cup where teams sit back, he can create, he can play those little one-twos, he can... He can get in between lines. He's good with the ball at his feet. He makes things happen. And to add to all of that, he's experienced. He's been there, done that. And I think what people really underestimate when they're looking at the Socceroos in isolation, and I know Arnie's talked about it a little bit, but I think he probably could even stress it more, to be honest. He's a pretty good get out of jail card. This is a very inexperienced group on the whole. There are a lot of players with not that many caps, bar Jackson Irvine sort of, in midfield. Even guys like Harry Soutar don't have that many caps. So a player like Luongo's got 50-plus caps is exactly what you need, to be honest, especially when it comes time for tournament football.
It's going to be looking ahead to November. I'm quite intrigued to see what he does with the squad, because at these past two windows, he's real Graham Arnold decrying as he does so, has predominantly left out a number of A-League men players just because the season hasn't started. They're not match fit. They're not playing versus these other players in Europe. Yes, he's brought in, you know, a few here and there. He brought in Brandon Borrello and Aziz Bajic, but neither of them, you know, really played major roles throughout the games. Aziz Bajic, of course, starting today, but he's probably, of all the A-League players, given Melbourne City's deep Australia Cup run and Asian Champions League, as close to match fit as you can get for domestic-based players. But by the time November rolls around, you'll be a month into the A-League men campaign. Some of these players will be getting extended minutes into their leg. All indications are that Matthew Leckie is actually going to be back for round one for Melbourne City. And if he's got a month...
If so, I still wouldn't be surprised if we don't see him till round two or three, Joey, just because he's such an important asset. But the fact that he's put himself in the position,
he's a machine
available, much like Jackson Irvine with these Socceroos friendlies in the UK. Like some players are naturally very good heelers, but it just shows the work rate they have. And I think if you talk to people in Australian football, Matt Leckie is known throughout the whole joint as being one of the most professional players and great athletes going around. And it's extraordinary that he could be right for round one.
Yeah, and even if he's not right for round one, it's round two or three. Even if he's only got a fortnight's worth of football in him, Matthew Leckie he's going to be picked in this, or at least he should be picked in the squad. He's one of those players that he's absolutely going to be coming back in. And then you've got questions, you know, we saw Mo Touré make his debut against England, but do you keep bringing him back in, or does somebody like Jamie McLaren, who's had a month of football in the A-League men, come back if he's banging in 4, 5, 6 goals in the opening month, and you're playing against, you've got a home tie at the very least in Melbourne where he lives against Bangladesh. It's very hard to leave somebody like him out. Or maybe do you save one or two spaces, given that, with all due respect, it is Bangladesh and Palestine, two sides that Australia should be expected to comfortably beat. It's not being disrespectful for Asia. This is a side that made the round of 16 at the World Cup. Do you save a slot or two for what Arnie has been doing in, you know, maybe train on players or the like, where we saw Aaron Kunda as a train on option, Alex Robertson as a train on option? Do you save one or two places for a breakout young player in the A-League men's season? If Luka Jovanovic comes out for Adelaide United and scores a whole bunch of goals in the opening weeks, if Noah Botic scores a whole bunch of the opening weeks of the season, Johnny Yule's playing regular minutes, someone like that, do you bring them in and give them an apprenticeship as well? So that's going to be really interesting to see, because we are in the situation now wherein Graham Arnold isn't going to he's going to have to deal with the curse of plenty. The problem that he's got a lot of options in a lot of positions now. I never really bought the narrative that he didn't have the cashel during the last World Cup cycle. Mm. I took much more issues with deployments and utilization than the actual cattle itself. I think the squad was good enough, but nobody can use that excuse this time around. We've seen the talent on display, and really it's now going to be so intriguing to see, when competitive football begins, how they're utilized.
I think the willingness to bring in Mo Touré as a train-on player and then throw him on for a debut, I think, says that there will be that trust. And I think there'll be a lot of players who'll be locks for these World Cup qualifiers, right? And I think you have to probably throw Masalongo in there now based on how he's played. But, yeah, I don't see why you wouldn't leave gaps. I think Arnie would have done that deliberately, anticipating that there'll be players. And as, you know, long ago as, you know, 6 weeks ago, he would have been anticipating Craig Goodwin to be in that group of players before his move to Saudi, right? So I think you do leave some flexibility. And I think, to be fair, he's been pretty willing to do that. You see players like Metcalf before, I think he's more of a lock now. Denny Jonro, Cammy Devlin, they're the sort of players that he's willing to drop in and drop out depending on how they're going form-wise. Awa Mabil is another one in that category. And we've seen that a little bit of change with the goalkeepers by Matty Ryan as well. I think there will be room for players to prove themselves if you step up. And we know that quite often Arnie takes the approach with the younger players. Sometimes they get brought in as a train-on, or they get brought in with, you know, with no promises. We saw that with Aaron Kunda. You come in, you experience the environment, and who knows what can happen. And yeah, the squad for these World Cup qualifiers may be a little bit different looking to the Asian Cup when there's silverware on the line. But Joey, I feel like you're burying the lead, because I'm looking at your rundown and I know this is all building up to something, and This is a very topic that I sense is very close to the TNC listeners' hearts. I know Nick Devano isn't here to join us for this.
No, the microwave ate him. He's half microwave now. He just got cooked inside that microwave. It snuck up on him. It was awful, awful scenes. But you are right. What a way to go.
It's Christian Volpato, maybe not. Arnie's talking about him. Who knows what's going on? Is it Christian Volpato hour? Is it near, Joey?
Well, it seems to be on the global game with Simon Hill. It wasn't subtle whatsoever, but he lampshaded that Christian Volpato was set to throw himself into Socceroos contention, to commit himself to the green and gold. And one would have to believe that that is a proper commitment, given that previous tug of war players that have committed, your Alex Robertsons, your Jacardis.
Who made his debut overnight and looked pretty confident, eh?
Mm. But when they've all come in, Arnold has been very clear that they have committed. You know, Alex Robertson and Sokardi, they're not just coming in as senior Socceroos. They have indicated that they're committed for Paris. They're going to be committed for Oli Roos. So one would have to think that he's not, you know, it would go against everything that Arnold especially in the last year or so, has attempted to do by giving special treatment to Volpato and just bringing him in purely as a senior Socceroo or with some sort of expectations of minutes. So that is going to be, you know, it's going to be very interesting to watch, because yes, we talk about in the coming World Cup qualifiers, there may be scope for experimentation and giving players a look that otherwise might not be because of that. Because when you look at Volpato right now, he's not like a walk up selection for the Socceroos. He's played 13 minutes of football.
He's not in a position of strength. His position of strength was before, you know, when he would have been, had he not
in the World Cup,
called up for the World Cup, when he was getting minutes for Roma, he was scoring some goals, he was impressing. We know he's since made a move in Clubland, and he's not been playing a heap. And
it's 13 minutes versus Swallow.
Exactly. And, you know, I think, credit to Graham Arnold and co, that it seems like as much as some conversations have been happening, it's not been pushing. He wasn't forced to make that decision. You know, players who are eligible for multiple countries can take time. Maybe he thought at the time, you know, we know that things didn't work out for him in terms of A-League clubs. He obviously felt very welcomed in Italy. Things were going well for him. But sometimes all you need is time to figure out what you actually want. And maybe for him, it could have been a level of seeing where he was actually at in terms of the Italy pecking order. We know he scored for their, I think they're under 20s about 5 weeks ago, maybe. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. The one thing that Arnie has made very clear, and I think this has been a pretty common thing with FA generally, is they're not engaging in hardcore, well, with the Socceroos at least, hardcore tug of war, right? They're not saying, you know, oh, come and feel this and see what you think and see how you like the Socceroos, but then maybe you might like Italy better. That expectation is commitment, right? Like, as you say, it's been pretty clear. Players are getting called in once they say, no, I want to play for the Socceroos. And I think the discussion that we've seen on Twitter today has been, and fair enough, easy. He knocked back a guaranteed World Cup squad selection, albeit pretty close to guaranteed, right? To, you know, see what his options were with Italy. And now he's coming in. But, you know, he had every right to take his time. He's a teenager. And if they think he's going to be committed now, then, you know, he'll get his chance to show that. But I would agree with you, Joey. I don't think he's going to get called up based on vibes and based on, maybe I'll go to Australia. I think it will be a full commitment. And if that's the case, then, you know, they deserve credit for the way they've gone about it, because I think that careful approach worked really well with Robertson and Sicardi. They made those choices themselves based on what they felt was right. And I think that's something that Arnie's always been very strong on. Like, I'm not going to coerce someone into playing for Australia, or, you know, say you're not going to get a shot here, so you should play for us. It's, do you want to play for Australia? Yeah. And the thing is now, there's quite, as you said just before, when we were talking about Luongo and Metcalf and A-League players, there's a fair old logjam in midfield, and especially in attacking midfield roles. We've seen Riley McGree spend a lot of time on a wing. Like, Metcalf has played on a wing as well. Like, it's not like, and, you know, Aidan Rostich has obviously had his issues with injury, and his injury was probably why that spot looked like it might really open up for Volpato come World Cup time. But, yeah, it's no guarantee. You're not going to walk into this team So if he's committed, he's also committed to fight for a spot, right?
Yeah, and he's going to have to fight because, as you said, Riley McGree, Conor Metcalf, Alex Robertson, Marco Tilio, Aiden Hrustic, if he can come good. Mas Luongo can push up. Denny Jonro can push up and play in there. There's a ton of competition there. And whilst only Denny Jonro is starting week in and week out in the top flight league of that crew, well, even he's not starting week in and week out, but he's starting intermittently. The others are at least playing. And Valpardo will be training week in and week out in the high Serie A class environment, but that's not the same as playing. Not only will he have to beat out those players when it comes to performing for the Socceroos, he's going to have to earn his right to even compete with them in a camp when things come around. But we will move on because we are running out of time and it is trade week. So we are going to lose AAP's finest to trade week eventually. But A-League men, we won't have time to run through all of those teams, Harrow, and we have already discussed in detail the grand final decision. But from an on-field perspective, what's your vibe with the season, which kicks off this Friday when the Central Coast Mariners come to head to Adelaide, I should say, to face off with Adelaide United? Who do you think actually looks good? Because one of the things that's notable for me is that it's one of those seasons where a lot of sides are either treading water or maybe even getting a bit worse simply because players have left. Obviously, Mariners have gotten worse. Adelaide have gotten worse purely because the type of players that have left. The Jets are stuck in this perpetual state of purgatory, unable to bring good players and the like. Melbourne City, we don't know. They lost 9 starting caliber players. Yeah. They brought in good
players.
They're
going to take time to settle, I think. Brought some quality in, but it'll take time.
I mean, maybe it'd be sure to say, Harrow, who do you think has definitively gotten better heading into this A-League season?
Well, I think based off their pre-seasons at least, Brisbane Roar, Sydney FC, look to have made astute signings. Ross Aloisi's come in and there looks to be a new energy about the Roar. I know the Australia Cup final didn't go their way, but they were playing good. You could tell what he's taken away from his time with Kevin Muscat in Japan as well, right, the way that they were playing. You've got young Waddingham up front, who's a really exciting player. When we talk about youngsters, that's something that really excites me. Sydney FC look re-energised. It looks like they've made the changes they need to. If they can keep Lolly and Mac fit, I love that Patrick Wood has stepped up across the pre-season and they've also had Fabio come in. So to me, that looks like a team that can get back up and about and do some really good things.
Max Burgess.
Yes, Max Burgess experience. Fresh off his summer in South America. It's winter in South America. I haven't, to be fair, I haven't watched enough of Perth yet, but I like the change they made. I like the decision that Stage has made to go with Adam Taggart as captain. I always like when you get a sort of heart and soul local player in that wants to do their city proud. And I think they've recruited pretty astutely. Victory, jury's out. I think there's some excitement there. Getting back Brimmer from injury will be big. Arzani has done a little bit in the preseason. Brian Teague, I like all those pickups. They needed some fresh legs.
I think Raimar Chan coming back in the midfield is going to be big for him because ostensibly he allows them to play a single pivot, which is going to enable them to have a bit more movement.
Such an underrated player, I think, Raimar Chan. Not by us, but I think in the sense of the league overall, I think he's really important. And takes so much of that defensive work that allows Brimmer to be that real sort of forward half player, for want of a better word. He doesn't need to do so much of the other type of running. He can get creative and do what he is best at, right? For me also, I don't know if they will necessarily be up in the upper echelon, but I like that Western United, bar signing Nikita Rukavica, have largely pivoted towards youth. That really excites me. Noah Bocic getting given the keys in attack. I spoke to him the other day and he seems very confident coming off a good preseason, scored 6 goals last year. Seems like a player that can really break out. And a lot of their signings are that bit younger as well. I like that they've brought in Thurgate. I think that extra bit of energy they needed to revamp and regenerate. And for me, that's really important, giving some of the younger players the keys. I think Melbourne City will be fine. I just think they'll take a little bit of time to bed things down. I think Andrew Naboot is a bigger loss than a lot of people maybe listening would think because he just knows how to play their system. You know what you're going to get with him every week, right? And when bang, that, bang, bang. And Lecky, you'd think, will take a little bit of time to warm up, even if he is, you know, back in straight away. We know what a professional he is, but coming off an injury, it will take a bit of time. But I think players like Ugarkovic and Antonis, they know the league. They know how to play it. It's not like you're just bringing in foreign signings who sometimes get here and go, oh, my God, it's 30 degrees. I'm cool. Like, it's you know, you've got players that know how the league works. As is Bage, yeah. Really astute signing, right? He's not going to let you down. Like,
yeah.
Those sorts of players, I think they'll be okay. Who excites you, Joe? I think I've stolen everyone good.
Well, it's going to be interesting for me to see Western United going to be playing out of their training base since I need now. We got the confirmation of that. I think it needs to be made very clear that this is not a stadium. It shouldn't be allowed to be treated as their stadium. They need to still be held to account, and they still need to, you know, provide the answer to the question, where is the stadium that, you know, was the cornerstone of your case for an expansion license? However, it is good to see that they'll be finally playing out actually in the west of Melbourne and able to build up some sort of identity out there. For me, one of the most intriguing stories, though, it's in Sydney's west, Western Sydney Wanderers, returning to the finals for the first time in half a decade last season, and then knocked out by Sydney FC on their turf when it was mostly all Wanderers in the stands because Sydney fans were boycotting that game over the grand final decision. Can the Western Sydney Wanderers actually kick on and, you know, continue to build upon what was, you know, a very good first full season for Marco Rodan out there in the West? He obviously got brought in as a caretaker for Carl Robinson in his first campaign. But they really do intrigue me because on paper, their squad, a case can be made that on paper, you know, Sydney FC and Western Sydney Wanderers squads are two of the strongest in the league. The Wanderers have obviously brought in Marcus Antonsson, the Swedish attacker, and Jorrit Hendricks late on in the process, the Dutch midfielder whose resume can, you know, absolutely blows you away when you see what he's done. So it could be a situation wherein if the cards fall, if Melbourne City get off to a slow start, it could be the Wanderers and Sydney FC battling it out for the premiership if things fall right, which would be, you know, quite something, because we have
the grand final in Melbourne then.
That would be something. But yes, let's do that. Start the grand final campaign. Sydney Derby grand final in Melbourne. But because we haven't really had a season though where like the Wanderers and Sydney have been really good at the same time. Even last season when there was a lot of excitement about Sydney, the Western Sydney, and Sydney sort of felt like there was a lot of focus on Steve Corica. Was he going to lose his job or not? But so, if those two teams are really good, that has the potential to be the defining storyline of this A-League men's season, this big Sydney Derby rivalry. We saw a few years ago, Melbourne teams 1-2-3 on the table. We had a Melbourne Derby grand final between City and Western United. But those rivalries don't quite have the same deep, visceral buy-in from the fan bases like the Sydney Derby does. So that could, once again, coming off a grand final decision, giving the game a bit of momentum, some other, you know, good decisions made during the off-season, the developmental focus. We got Pause and Rewind on Paramount now and the like. A Sydney Derby rivalry throughout the season could be a really defining one for me if it reaches that point come finals time. But, Haro, I'm also very conscious of timing. You do need to go and walk Vincho, do you not?
Yes, and then go get into the trade. Sorry for the... I know the no Sharon rule, like, I know, but sometimes it is an inescapable part of my life, dear listeners.
Okay, here we go. AFL trade radio, yeah. Harrow. A League of Trade Radio. Give me one trade that you would make in the A-League.
Like, because I think it would be a smart one to do, or because...
No, do purely for vibes, purely for bands.
The pressure's on. It has to involve. You stuck me here. I think I'm gonna have to go Max Burgess to the new Auckland team solely so we can start a team based on players who wear black boots, short socks, have the look, have the vibe, have a cult feel. It'll piss off people in Wellington straight away. Because they like to think they're the more hipster town in New Zealand. So that's just a little niche one to rile up those types. Joe, you've surely got one in mind.
Jamie McLaren to Western United.
Ah, see, I've got Jamie McLaren to Perth Glory.
Oh, no. He would hate that. He would nix the trade. He would retire. But Jamie McLaren to Western United.
Sunbury.
He's a Sunbury boy. Western would go full on with it. Our hometown boy. All of that sort of stuff. You know McLaren's a good enough media performer so that he'd embrace it and he'd talk about it. And it would piss off City fans and it would piss off everybody else because it would become a giant narrative and nobody likes to pay attention to any narratives involving that rivalry. So that would be my banterific AFL trade radio, our Liga edition. But Anna Harrington, it's been incredible to have you with us. I'm going to chat after the break with Lonnie Johnson for All Things Dub. Reminder to all of our listeners that if you want Anna Harrington's takes on the Dub and All Things Women's Football, the far superior ones to mine, you can catch them on the Far Post podcast, part of that Sippin' on the ESPN Juice podcasting family. Harrow, when can we hear that?
Well, we're now recording every Monday morning, bright and early, pre-coffee, which is experimental to say the least, but you get your dub takes that bit earlier. But no, we had my esteemed colleague George on last week. Thank you for having me on. My player to watch, it's got to be Noah Bocic, doesn't it? Like, he's the player I'm playing most. It's just got to be who's your player to watch?
It was Noah Bocic. I'm going to have to think of another one.
No. That's also a good one. So, no, I'm pretty excited to see how this season plays out. Hopefully some better fortunes bar Melbourne City and Melbourne, hey? But, yes, thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Yes, and welcome back to the National Curriculum Podcast. For you, just a few seconds have passed, but through the magic of editing, I can actually inform you that it is the next morning and we are about to speak now with, a rising star in Australian football media. She is a freelance football journalist. She is also the Digital Engagement Officer at the Office for Women in Sport and Recreation at the Victorian Government. So I'm about to hit her up and ask us for some funding for something I want to build in my back garden and I'm going to claim it's for grassroots initiatives. Lonnie Johnson, thank you ever so much for joining us. The Dub is back. The Matilda squad is ours. Where it gets at all that. Are you just excited? We've had the Women's World Cup and now the Dub is here. Are you excited?
Oh, I'm over the moon. I think it feels like it's been such a long time since the last Dub and, you know, coming off the back of such a successful World Cup and seeing the way that Aussies have just gotten around the whole league and women's sport, football in particular, I think this round of A-League Women's is going to be incredible.
Mm. And Lani, obviously, you know, I'm familiar with your work and what you've been done, but some of the listeners might not be because you do have a pretty decent grounding in football as well as your work in the media space and in the Victorian government. You're a player yourself. Do you maybe just want to, as a bit of an introduction, as it is your first time on TNC, you are making your debut, maybe give us a bit of an insight into your own history in football, your own experiences.
Yeah, for sure. Sub me on. So I've been playing football since I was about 7 years old. I started playing in Sydney in New South Wales and played for a few different clubs in the NPL there. And then the last 2 years I've been with Berlin Lions in the NPL in Victoria, where a lot of our Melbourne Victory girls come from. And in terms of just writing about sport and football, I've started that throughout uni, so about 4 or 5 years ago now. Worked for a bunch of different outlets, lots of freelance work. And at the moment, as you mentioned, working in the Office of Women in Sport and Recreation. So it's part of the Vic government. And the whole aim there is just to get more women and girls playing sport, being active and healthy. So done a little bit of lots of different things in the last few years, but football is where my heart's at. And yeah, we'd love to kind of see where that can take me.
Mm, indeed. Well, we will tag you in the posts that we put out on our socials in the episode description. But if you somehow manage to miss those, Lonnie Johnson is Lonnie Johnson 2000 on Twitter. Whenever Twitter explodes, and I refuse to call it X, when that explodes and we all move on to migrate to the new thing, we'll let people know where they can find you on that front. But we will crack into it. Now, Lonnie, I did have a big discussion with Harrow yesterday about the grand final decision. And inevitably, it feels like a lot of those discussions have centered around the men's grand final because the men's grand final was tied into the Festival of Football concept. We were supposed to have Bayern Munich as part of that week. That's when the let's call it famous grand final party took place. And there was also the fact that it felt like the Women's World Cup had sort of
allowed the A-League women to sort of escape the shadow of that decision and get some good vibes going. But this is a decision that is also going to affect the A-League's women competition now, the Unite Rounds. That's going to be for A-League men and A-League women. And in fact, the A-League women will not be adding an extra rounds this season. They will just be having their 12th rounds co-opted, and that will now be the Unite round. So a few teams do lose a home game. I think that's just because it was unviable to add an extra round at this point with schedules and all of that. And the thinking was people would rather have the chance to win a home grand final than wait for it to come in next year. But Lani, when you saw this announcement come in, and have you, now that you've had a chance to think about it, what do you think it's like? How do you see it through an A-League women's, through a dub sphere?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good thing. And it's important to point out that a lot of the discussion around it has, been in context of the men's A-League, and that, we've seen this work for other codes before. I think it is, at the end of the day, it's going to be a good thing. It's going to be a festival of football where we can get everyone together in the one place, a chance for, fans to come together from around the country. And, it's worked in other sporting codes, but it's also the first time I think that it's been both men's and women's that have come together for a magic round or a Unite round. So it'll be really interesting to see how it goes. Overall, I think it's a positive. As you've mentioned too, some teams are always going to lose out. Sometimes it's just the way it goes. But hopefully, other states can bid to host the Unite rounds in the future, might be able to share it around. And I think, overall, it's going to be a really good thing.
Because it's been fashioned as a great away day. So I think the ultimate, I'm not familiar with the actual, branding. This is why I work in the media and not the other way around. But the dynamics of women's football fandom, they are different, of course, than men's football. It's a lot more genial in my experience. You find a lot more people that are sort of just fans of the entire league than more so just one team. There's a lot less, I'm not going to say hostility, but there's a lot less, machismo between interact. We wouldn't be getting a tug of war like we saw with Section 22 at the Australia Cup final in the women's game. How do you think, does a Unite rounds bringing all the rounds together, how do you think that that's going to work for women's football fans? Obviously, the demographics are different as well. It tends to be a bit younger and oftentimes casual work and the like, which is difficult. How do you think that'll work?
Yeah, it's interesting. And maybe the F3 derby might kind of go against your hostility comment there. But
players. I think the fans got on.
Oh, the fans, yes. Yeah, that's, I think the fans quite enjoyed it, actually. But I think, you're right. The men's football landscape and the women's football landscape's quite different. And, we've seen in the past women's sport, not just football, but every sport coming together to support the women. It's, I think, in men's football, it's a lot more segregated. And if you follow one particular code, then that's your code. The storylines and the players themselves are what seems to draw in a lot of the fans in the women's space. And, you might follow a player from one club to another and not necessarily follow one particular club for whatever reason that might be. Maybe the league's just a bit more in its infancy and, we like to follow along with the narratives of the players. But I see it working. I think it's going to be a very busy weekend. It's going to be different to what we've kind of ever had before. There'll be draw cards for people to come out and watch all the games all together in the one spot. I'm really hoping it's going to be a good thing. People that are working in the sport, like media, it's going to be difficult too because it's
nobody cares about us with good reason.
That's true. We're awful. It's all about the fans, isn't it? But no, at the end of the day, I think it's worth giving it a go. I think it's worth kind of seeing how it plays out and maybe reassessing after the end of that weekend in January for the future and if that's a positive for the men's, but also if it's going to be positive for the women as well.
Because reflecting on it, it felt like for me like this sort of like flicked a switch and a panacea wasn't reached in the men's game by any means, but it sort of helped shift the narrative around a little bit. There's probably still distrust, but
it was less morose. There was less cynicism. There was a reason again for optimism surrounding the A-League men. The A-League women already had that at the time of this announcement. The halo effect of the Women's World Cup, the Matildas effect, there were already good vibes surrounding the competition. And now we've had this grand final reversal as well. In my experience, Lani, and you know, it's very high level because I'm flittering from one thing to another and I can't really dive into the reads, but it feels like the supporters of the women's game they weren't so much boycotting as much as the men, because there is that understanding that, you know, if metrics fall off a cliff for the women's game, people are just going to use that as an excuse to just cut back on resourcing. They're not going to see the protest. They're going to see the outcome. But now with something like this, I feel like vibes around the A-League women can potentially grow to an even greater level, and engagement by supporters now knowing that, you know, if you're a Western United fan, and if you can, you'll never get that home grand final back, unfortunately, but you now, if you reach another one, you might be able to host it. Do you think this is something that really can now be leveraged in promoting that women's football space?
Oh yeah, 100%. Like, as you said, the kind of afterglow of the Matildas effect, as we're calling it, has gone above and beyond, I think, what we thought it would do before the World Cup. And, you know, even just to see 11,500 fans at the Sydney Derby over the weekend, you know, obviously there's a real passion, and the fans want to come out and they want to watch these women play. And it's not just the narrative around supporting the women. We're beyond that now. People just want to come and watch good football. And yeah, as you've mentioned, that there already was that kind of trust, I think, and those good vibes surrounding the A-League women, even though, you know, there isn't actually that many Matildas playing in the league, but it's been marketed in such a way that, you know, if you enjoyed the World Cup, if you love supporting the Matildas, then this is the next thing for you. Like, get on down, celebrate the women, come and watch the games. And I think that's something that's been working so far, at least in round one. We've seen it work, and I really hope we can keep that momentum going for the rest of the season, you know, round two, round three this season, and the season after that, and the one following. So I think only time will tell, but at the moment it does feel like there is that trust in the league and in the government too, for revoking the decision and for putting the fans first. And, you know, just hopefully we see it all come together. Hopefully we see us, you know, as players and fans, just as a football community, rise even better. And in January, you know, we'll see double the amount of people coming in and supporting the game and watching and getting together. I think it's going to be a really, really great opportunity. So I can't wait.
I mean, yeah, looking at this, we saw the standalone crowd record set across the weekend in that Sydney Derby, as you said, 11,500. I mean, if I was the APL, I would absolutely be trying to sell out. And, you know, this Unite round, you've got fans coming in from all around the country. It might be made a bit harder by the very nature of this concept, means that there will be a clash with a men's game on at the same time, which means that you can't get everyone in. But it looks like they have at least scheduled teams on separate days, so you can get to the men's and women's games. But if that was, you know, me, if I was running the APL, which probably many people at the APL are thankful that I'm not, I would absolutely be trying to sell out and set a new record somewhere, you know, get 14,000-15,000, really pump the heck out of one of these games and really try to make new marks. And because if you are going to sell out for this Unite if you are going to go all in on this Unite concept and, you know, really try to establish that it's not just for the men, it's for the women, here you go. It's another chance to demonstrate that not only was the Matildas effect here in round one, but it's got a bit of sticking power. So we'll see in the coming months how they actually go with that. But we have been talking about the Matildas effect quite a bit, and the Matildas are actually going to be in action very soon. Actually, the squad has been announced. They are headed to Perth for Olympic qualifiers against Philippines, Iran, and Taiwan, Chinese Taipei,
for the right to progress to the next round of Asian qualifying. We saw the squad come out and it was announced, and well, it's a very familiar squad. Only two players drop out from the World Cup 23, Ivy Lewick and Kaya Simon, both injured. Amy Sayer comes in as a full member of what is just a 22-player squad, while Charlie Rule is going to come in as a train-on. And I guess my first reaction when I saw this, Lani, is that there's always questions after a World Cup, albeit the women's cycle is a bit different given the importance that the Olympics holds in senior football. But there's always a question about the Women's World Cup, especially a home Women's World Cup that has felt like it's the be-all and end-all for so many years. Would we see transition? Would we see players begin to step away? Would we see any retirements? And whilst Ivy Lewick's not in the squad, who ostensibly would be one of the premier candidates for doing one of those things, it very much looks like the band is going to be kept together for the Olympics, which I guess isn't a surprise, because if you are an elite level footballer and we know the core of that squad has been kept together for so long, it feels inevitable they're going to hang on for as long as they possibly can. I mean, what was your reaction when you first saw that squad?
Yeah, I think I completely agree. My first reaction was, you know, oh, yep, makes sense. No surprises. I mean, if I was a player and I'd just, you know, been in that World Cup tournament, I wouldn't be wanting to retire either. I'd be wanting to ride out this wave, you know, and stay with the same squad and the same team for as long as possible. So, yeah, my initial kind of reaction was, you know, no surprises. This is the squad that's been working. Like, let's, yeah, as you said, keep the band together. But then I guess as I was reflecting a little bit further, I was thinking, you know, it is a full strength squad, but maybe this is an opportunity to get some other players into the setup, like some younger players even. You know, we've seen Mackenzie Hawkesbury, Millionaires, like performing really well, even Jada Wyman in terms of a keeper. Like, would it have been a good idea potentially to try to blood some of these younger players into the squad? I guess on the one hand, that's, you know, a possibility, but on the other, we've seen just this team be so successful, and really you can't really take any of them out, so there'd have to be some drastic changes or injuries, and the Olympics is only 8 months away or so now, so there's not actually that much time. You know, it did bring a smile to my face to see Charlie Rule caught up as a train-on or a development player, and she's been doing really well at Brighton Hove Albion. I think she scored a goal last week, so that was really good. But yeah, I think the overarching kind of idea in my head anyway was, no surprises, play on.
Tony Gustafsson, his contract is up after the Paris Olympics, and given the subject of the interest that he, you know, reports of the US job, there's, and of course he has come into criticism as well for his game management and the likes of the Women's World Cup, it feels remarkable that we could, but I guess also a sign of a bit of a maturation of Australia as a football nation that we are having these conversations around, yes, we made the semi-final, but could we have done better? And he's been the target of that. So, but given that he's contracted to the end of the Olympics, it maybe doesn't surprise me that he's gone with this full strength team as well, simply because he doesn't know if he's going to be around post the Olympics. Why would he had the KPI to blood new talent and develop new talent early in his tenure, but now that he's come towards the end of it and he's trying to either secure a new contract with Football Australia, he's probably hoping for a raise as well if that's the case, or he's trying to advertise himself for jobs elsewhere, why wouldn't you sell out and do everything you can to get, you know, pump as many goals past oppositions and qualify for the Olympics and go for medals at the Olympics as you possibly can to set yourself up for the next chapter? Because really, like, the Matildas shouldn't need a full strength squad to, certainly Taiwan and Iran shouldn't require a full strength squad. Philippines, obviously a rising nation, but then again, like you see the recent Asian Games struggling against under strength Korean and Japanese sides. Ostensibly, you shouldn't need your World Cup semi-final squad to at least get results from that game, given that the best second place sides from the three qualifying groups, the best one from that also qualifies. And also, I guess, like, I can see the reasoning behind it, but also, like, the likes of Sam Kerr, who's, you know, still been battling coming back from an injury for Chelsea, you know, hasn't started a game yet.
I don't think. I know she's come off the bench and scored a goal. There's just so much football to follow. But she's still battling back from an injury. She hasn't had the most fluid start to the season. Now she's going to get on a plane and come all the way back to Australia, do this camp, and then fly all the way back to England. And that's the same for a lot of these players, especially in the, you know, in these European leagues that basically did an entire European league season, did the World Cup, and then straight into another European league season. It's just a lot of wear and tear on bodies and minds as well. And yeah, like, do you think, like, do you reckon it will be a case of manner like that some of these players like Kerr will be named in the squad but probably actually won't feature in all three games?
I think that would probably be a smart decision, yeah. It does seem like Tony's gone with a bit of the safe bet. You know, he knows what works. He knows that this is a squad that's performed well together. But, you know, we didn't have Sam for a majority of the World Cup, and, you know, we were playing against, you know, arguably more difficult opponents then. And, you know, we still did really well. And I would hope that in these qualifying games, he is able to rest players like Sam, or those that maybe do have a higher load, or, you know, kind of switch around some players a bit just to keep everyone fresh, because yeah, it is a lot in your body. And as you mentioned too, it's a lot just mentally and emotionally. Like, the travel itself is draining, you know, having to go to these really difficult camps where you're training multiple times in a day, gym recovery, like, you have to be switched on mentally all the time. And yeah, I think it's, if we can still qualify, but kind of maybe give some of the other, like, outside kind of squad members more of a run and rest some of those players so that we can really turn it on when the Olympics does come our way, hopefully. I think that would be a smart decision.
Alex Chidiot getting on the park when the Matildas aren't 3-1 down. What a turnaround that would be. but I think the other elephant in the room, I guess, is that sort of like this entire run of qualifiers, this homecoming, sort of, as it were, it's been marketed around the likes of Kerr and Catley and Ford and all that as well. So, you know, selling out and HBF Park, forcing one of the games to go to Optus Stadium. Commercially, there is no doubt a heavy push to get these players involved as well. Even though, interestingly, I think, as far as I'm aware, nothing's been announced, there's still no collective bargaining agreement for the national team. So I'm not sure what framework would exist to actually leverage these players' brands when they're in camp itself, whether you could, you know, they'll be doing photo shoots or they'll be doing commercial opportunities, which, you know, is, you know, perhaps squandering the golden goose if you are dragging on these CBA negotiations. But it should be interesting. Like, they should handily dispatch, certainly. I'm hedging my bets on the Philippines purely because Torcaso is coach, and he'll give me shit if I just say they'll be easily defeated by that. But they should handily progress through to the next stages. But then, of course, well, the potentially a playoff with, like, a Korea or Japan. Lani, this is a long way away. But right now, if the Matildas were to come up against Japan in a playoff to qualify for the Olympics, Japan would be favourites in that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? I think you know, Matildas have come a long way, and we've had a great campaign at the World Cup, and there's a lot of hype going along still. But the Japanese squad and just the way that they've been performing lately,
they're really good.
I think it would definitely be a great matchup. You know, they're just technically so proficient. I think, yeah, it would be difficult. It would be really difficult
because technically, like, you see it in even the NPLW, we get, like, this season in Victoria, there were several Japanese players that came out. Even these players coming from, like, semi-pro ranks in Japan, they're technically incredibly proficient, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. You know, playing against some of these girls in the NPL even, and that, yeah, I think technically incredible. Skill on the ball, like, the pace. It's really hard to read what their next move is going to be. So, you know, there's something's happening in Japan, and the next kind of generation of players that are coming from there. They're just really technically proficient. They all work really hard, and as a country, they're just improving exponentially. So it's going to be really interesting to follow their run along the next few years as well, and see kind of what happens there.
Well, just for everybody's sanity's sake, let's just hope the Matildas don't draw Japan in a Olympic qualifier. Let's just get somebody else, and we don't have to worry about this. But aside from so we've talked about the internationals, we've talked a bit about Magic Round, but it was the opening round of the dub across the weekend, and you can't beat around the bush. It went excellently. It's setting a new record for crowds across a single round of this A-League Women's competition, setting a crowd record in the opening game, the F3 derby between the Mariners and the Jets, only for that record to get smashed later that night by the Sydney derby. As you mentioned, 11,500. You had a full house at the home of the Matildas on the Sunday to watch Brisbane Roar upset Melbourne Victory 2-0, and a rather off the boil Melbourne Victory upsetting them. But you're also seeing just the other games from around the country not setting records, but still looking like fantastic spectacles that we're really enjoying. The Knicks going down, battling going down against Melbourne City, whatever madness took place between Adelaide United and Canberra United, and then Perth Glory. Laying down a bit of a marker in defeating Western United 2-0. But we'll get to any major takeaways or themes from the games in a second. But Lani, I think overall, like we touched a bit on the vibe, but looking at the actual round itself, probably, about as good as one could realistically expected from an entire package of the opening round.
There's not much more you can ask for, is there? Like, we've got record-breaking crowd numbers, fights in red cards, some really great contenders for goal of the seasons already. We've got a match that has 8 goals in it. Honestly, it's going to be hard for round 2 or any other round to really beat it. I think those kind of newer fans to the game that might have kind of jumped on board since the World Cup, they've been really treated to a great first round of the dub. And can't wait for this weekend, really, to see what happens next.
Because that was important, wasn't it? There was a lot of talk about, people will get involved. We've sold all of these memberships, all of these, Liberty passes or whatever. These free passes for juniors have been given out so they can get into the games for free. But you also have to give people a reason to keep coming back. And if they'd all come to round one and it had been crap, it would have, you can't just rely on, hey, Sam Kerr, isn't she great? Come and swelter in a crappy stadium watching poor football. But it wasn't that. Like, once again, a case, if you build it, they will come. The games were being played in good quality stadia. The players, did their job. When you actually treat them like professionals, what do you know? You actually get decent performances. I mean, we even had, a rare appearance on terrestrial TV on 10 Bold. The Sydney Derby was actually on telly, and it got the full halftime show and pregame show and all of that sort of stuff. And what do you know? It was fantastic. Maybe in comparison to the other games where no halftime show and just no pregame and anything like that. But it really was important, I think, for the league to put on a good, get on the front foot with the league. And aside from some of my pedantic points, or maybe not so pedantic, depending upon your point of view, it really did manage that well. Of course, one of these things that I've always thought, I've said this previously on the show, Lani, is like, we got all these fans through the door, the Matildas effect, come and support the girls, the inspiration. One of the questions I've always had, and I'd love to get your view on this, debut show, so I'm throwing you to the wolves. One of the things I've always wondered is when we'll make that transition to the point where, and I know I've discussed this with A-League Women's commentator Georgia Radjic as well, when we'll reach the point when marketing these competitions, not as just being inspirational, not just being come and support the girls, come and bring the kids to get inspired. It's come and see these awesome athletes, and we're getting people following storylines, not just here's the inspirational story of Jane Doe, who walked up a hill both ways to get to and from training and didn't own boots and had to, sell a kidney to fund her mother's cancer treatment and still made it anyway. And we're just wondering about, oh God, Melina, her hamstring. Is she going to get up?
I'm going to click on that story and read that, and I'm going to follow this and all that sort of stuff. How do you, like, is that a transition that the Leafs, am I talking out of my ass? Does women's football need to make that transition? Or if it does, how do we get there?
Yeah, I think we're on the way to that transition. You know, a lot of the, I guess, the marketing, the promotion around women's sport forever has always been, you know, come and support the girls, you know, get down and see this inspirational story, like, as you've said, blah, blah, blah. But already we're starting to see that cultural shift. Like, we're starting to see people go to watch these games of football because they are good games of football, not because they're women playing or men playing. You know, I've got friends, like men, that are going and watching the games because they want to watch sport. They want to watch a good game. I think a tweet from Marnie Vanel the other day, I think it was in relation to another code, but it was along these lines too, just saying, like, when are we going to...
We gladly flaunt our Sharon violations on TNC. You could say it was about the AFLW.
Yeah. It was about the AFLW. But basically just saying, like, when are we going to stop, you know, just saying, come and support the girls, and instead saying, like, come and watch some of, like, the most hectic grabs you're going to see in your life. Like, because that's really what it is. We are watching some of these goals, you know, from these women, and it does not matter that they are women. They're incredible. They are athletes in their own right. And, you know, I think it's definitely a shift that's starting to happen. I think the World Cup has really kick-started that for us in Australia, at least. And I don't think it'll be that much longer before we need to rely on these other marketing tactics to just bring people to the game. You know, as you said, last weekend, round one, we had a whole bunch of people, tens of thousands of people watching, and they've seen it for themselves. If we can continue to, you know, treat these women like the athletes that they are, give them a good, you know, good grounds, good pay, all of the tools and the facilities that they need to do what they do, then, yeah, build it and they will come. People will realize, people will keep on coming back, and, you know, this problem, it'll sort itself out.
Well, we have beaten around the bush for almost half an hour now, so maybe we should actually get to the games itself. It was the round one, and as you mentioned, it was madness. Madness in Adelaide, huge crowds in Sydney, Biff in the F3 Derby, City, well, almost getting blown off the park in a literal sense in New Zealand, and then escaping with a 1-0 win at the wind tunnel that is the Cake Tin against the Wellington Phoenix. Brisbane Roar coming to Melbourne and getting a 2-0 win over their former gaffer, Jeff Hopkins. But, I mean, if you had to pick a couple of things that stood out to you, Lani, from that round, what were they?
Yeah, I think the first one for me, high-scoring Adelaide-Canberra game. Very entertaining match as a kind of neutral supporter, I guess. You wouldn't think that either team would be very happy defensively, but there's a lot to take out of that game. You know, Canberra's still quite a young team, but loved watching Vesna Milivojevic just being absolutely everywhere on the park, doing what she does best, just doing all the simple things well, and also just seeing one of my friends and former teammates, Lana Janczewski, her little side foot assist outside of the left boot, flicking on to Hannah Blake, I think it was, to score that third goal for Adelaide. One of the highlights for me for that game and for this round, after she, you know, scores from the spot too. So that was one of the highlights for me from that game.
Because Adelaide, I know, as you mentioned, defensively it's not good, but scoring four goals for Adelaide has to be a positive sign for them, doesn't it? Because they obviously lost Fiona Wirtz to Sydney FC and the goals that she brought. But last year, what really brought Adelaide undone was the fact that they just couldn't score goals to save their life. They would create some chances as well, but I think from memory, they significantly underperformed their XG. They couldn't create good quality chances a lot of the time as well. That's got to be a good sign for Adelaide, isn't it? That, you know, they're actually just score. They were actually able to score some goals in round one, and that's something they can build on.
Yeah, totally. Like, 4 goals is quite a lot. I think there's a statistic in football that if you score 3 goals, then you've got like an 80% chance of winning the match. So to score 4, obviously, you know, didn't come to fruition this time, but to score 4 goals in a match, it's incredible. And, you know, now that we have, you know, a much longer season, we've, like, teams have time to kind of work out the pain points and to say, okay, like, this is a positive for us. We know how to get on the score sheet. We can now kind of work on defensively what we need to do there. Because for a lot of teams, and especially historically in women's football, it's been the opposite. You know, we've seen a lot of low scoring games or nil all, and not as much, I guess, attacking prowess. But to see 8 goals in a match, and to, you know, have Adelaide scoring 4 goals, I think it's a super positive thing for them as a club, and even just for the league. And then, yeah, get back and work on defence this week, I guess.
I think one of the other major takeaways for me, and you know, we have our stables here on TNC, our boy stables, which are for boys and girls, our boy stables, and Melina Reyes is absolutely in my stable. Love her as a striker, love what she can do. And one of the things that really jumped out to me, of course, she popped up and scored the goal, because that's what Melina Reyes does, and she got the Jets off to a winning start. And very intrigued to see what they do this season under Gary Van Egmond. And I mean, there's inevitably talk that, you know, Emily Van Egmond might pop up for a brief marquee stint at some point. But for me, one of the big things with Melina was we saw she did what she does. She gets in good positions. She scored goals when she gets the opportunity. But she looked fitter than I've actually seen her in years heading into this game. It looks like she's had the sea change, quite literally, moving to Newcastle. I want no doubt the surfing played a role in getting her to Newcastle. But it feels like if she is able to maintain, you know, what looks to be a great preseason and scoring goals, building that, is she the sort of player, Lani, because, you know, I'm biased, I think she absolutely can be in this role. Is she a player that can maybe start to push for Matilda's selection if she maintains fitness, brings that physicality level up? Because we know Tony Gustafsson has banged on about the difference in physical levels between the A-League women and the Matildas setup and the level you need to be at. Is she a player that you think can develop into Matildas?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think just she's got that X factor. She's got something special. She's in the right place at the right time, and she knows how to score a goal. So I think if she can maintain that level of fitness that she seems to have brought into round one, you know, keep on surfing, keep on doing what you're doing. Yeah, there's no reason, I think, in my mind why she can't be, considered for the next selection. She's still young, and she's, you know, just really, I think, coming into herself and her game. So there's only positive things ahead for Melina, and she's looking good. She's playing well. And yeah, she looks really fit. So it's an exciting future ahead for her, I think.
And one thing, I was interested to watch the Sydney Derby for a multitude of reasons, not just crowd watch and metric watch, but also this peculiar situation we've had with the Western Sydney Wanderers sacking Cat Smith 10 days out from the season. The club basically just sacked her, and then we still had no official explanation from the club as to that, which of course leads the rumour mill to run wild, and not going to repeat anything that we can't substantiate on this show, but nature abhors a vacuum and the internet abhors one even more. So we are seeing the rumour mill rise on that. And certainly at least the Wanderers were able to rally in the second half. One wonders how much that was Sydney laying off the gas, though, in their 2-0 win in the Sydney Derby. And of course, Sydney also having to deal with terrible news that Nat Toman went down and has suffered an ACL injury and is now out for the season. But the Wanderers in the first half, Mel Caceres coming off the bench probably helped a lot, given how much she helped raise their level. But they just weren't at the races at all in that opening 45. I mean, you're a player, Lani. Could you figure out what the Wanderers were trying to do? Did they actually have, to your eye, specific plan, or that they just weren't executing, or could you not even figure out what they were trying to do?
Yeah, it wasn't a great performance, was it? I think they just weren't doing the simple things right. You know, they weren't making their passes stick. They didn't really look threatening at all for most of the game. I don't think Jada Wyman had to really make a save. I think there was a bit too much focus on just, talking back to the referee and not just playing the game itself, you know. At the end of the day, you're here to play football, and it's been a rough ride for them, I guess, in the last couple of weeks. A lot of changes, as you've mentioned, with coaching and whatnot. But I think maybe the only reason that it wasn't a bit more of a whitewash and that it was 2-0 at the end of the day was because Nat Tobin did, you know, do her ACL and then had to come off. And then obviously Sydney FC was a little bit maybe like out of sorts a bit and took the foot off the gas for the rest of the game. But yeah, I think the Wanderers are really going to have to look inwards and kind of work out what they need to do from here on in to have a bit more of a game plan. And just, yeah, they've got to work out a lot of things, I think, between now and next week.
Because you don't want like the hammer the players unfairly, but like the club as a whole, it's like we've discussed it exhaustively on TNC. The club should be better than this. You know, they've got so much going on for them in terms of location, resourcing, brand strength, just everything. And it just keeps on not working. And at some point, something's got to give, and it just frustrates me. But another thing that frustrated me a lot over the weekend was Melbourne Victory in possession. They were rather toothless in their return. Their debut game at the home of the Matildas. I think the first time they ever actually played a game on the main pitch, because their pracky matches had been on the back pitches. But it just didn't seem to click. They were obviously missing Emily Gielnick and Elise Cullen-Knight. Elise Cullen-Knight coming in is going to be huge in that midfield to just sort of take charge. But Jeff Hopkins, after the game, he just flat out just said not pleased with the result, but not pleased with the performance either. Just weren't at the level that they need to be at. And Brisbane, one of these teams that were maybe hoping of doing something, but a lot pre-season, a lot of that was talked about, it's going to ride on Tamiki Yallop. Tamiki Yallop doesn't play, I think injury as well, but they still come down and get a 2-0 win. And you only need to see, certainly for Jenna McCormick against her firm aside and coming down and scoring that header, what it meant to her. They really just seem to almost ambush Melbourne Victory, Lani.
Yeah, they did. I think it was 2-1 in the end, wasn't it? I think there was a
late goal in the 91st minute.
Yeah. But they really did. I think like before the game, you probably would have put your money on Victory. But as you've said, that there's key players out for both sides. And I thought Raw actually played really well. They were quite organized. You know, Victory had some chances, but at the end of the day, they didn't look as threatening as what you might have thought. You know, I think a positive for Brisbane at the end of the day was youngster, you know, Grace Kiliamu just coming on and scoring a goal. I think she's 16 years old, and she had a good game and played. You know,
she has an exam on Friday.
Oh my gosh, does she? Would that be? You're 10? You're 11?
But Gareth McPherson post game saying yes, she's got an exam this Friday. She often the Brisbane's American imports will drop her at school after training in the morning.
That's incredible, isn't it? And I think, you know, in earlier Dub days, we saw a lot of like really young players coming up, and that was the norm. And I think it still is kind of now in some regards more than men's football, but it's still incredible to just have, you know, a 16-year-old come on and then score a goal, you know, in her debut. So kudos to her. But yeah, we'd like to see a bit more from Victory next week too.
Because we are probably running a little bit out of time, but Lani, when you're looking at the opening weekend, I mean, coming into this season, I think it was generally perceived as being Sydney, City, Victory, perceived as the favourites, and then maybe Western United just a teeny bit behind them, especially with some of their losses in the back line. And then below them, you sort of had your Canberra, Perth, and then maybe a tiny bit lower, your Brisbane's and Adelaide's and the like. Coming out of the rounds, does that tier list change for you? What teams have risen in your estimation? Which teams have maybe fallen a little bit?
Yeah, I think Sydney, obviously, I still think is going to do really well. One you know, I know it was for all, but I think Adelaide United is a team that we've got to watch out for, a bit of a dark horse potentially there. They've got some really good attacking players, and I think we can't discount them. It's a long season too, so there's still a bit of time to kind of go back to the drawing board and make sure they get a few of those defensive things right. You know, Victory was disappointing in round one, but I think they've still got a lot of potential, so I wouldn't rule them out yet either. I'm really not sure how it's going to go down, but if I had to at this point, I'd probably still put my money on Sydney FC.
One team that certainly vaulted their way further into, well, it's round one and it's a 22-week season, so you can't say they've vaulted into anything definitively, but Perth Glory, I think, really established themselves in my mind as this is a team that should absolutely, you know, be targeting finals football and should be massively disappointed if they don't qualify for finals football. They're taking out a win over Western United in that late game. It was a nightmarish day up at 5:45 for the Socceroos and then still up at 10 p.m. for the Dub. But they really did impress me. It was 0-0 at halftime, but then coming out in the second stanza and just grab it as they are wont to do, coming out and finding a way to get goals in these games. And Grace Jarlay with an absolute rocket. I think we know Grace Jarlay has talent. You and I saw it when she was playing for Heidelberg United that season, but she's represented New Zealand at the Women's World Cup. She's had multiple stints surrounding the Dub, but now I think she's at that age where she's really ready to sort of like take her game to another level and really establish herself. And I think she could low-key turn into one of the best signings of the season at Perth, really. And that Perth team, it's full of young talent as well. It's going to grow as the season goes on. It's got, importantly as well, it's got continuity. A lot of these players were there last season. Aparkis has been there. Alex Aparkis has been there for a number of years. It really feels like, to me, watching them against Western United, it's sort of cemented in their minds that this is the year where they should really begin to assert themselves a bit more than they have.
Yeah, totally. Low-key, I think Grace Jarlay definitely is. She's an incredible player. And, you know, to score that strike and top corner debut, sky's the limit for her. You know, I think another point is also Susan Fongsenkem. Great goal. She's on Team of the Week too, I think, this week. There's a lot of potential in this Perth squad. Sometimes I think that consistency can really play a role. You know, Alex Aparkis is obviously onto something there as well, keeping the core group together. And, he's been my coach before at Sydney University too. So he's a great coach. And I think, definitely we can't discount Perth either. So I'd love to see where they can take it from here.
I guess, the great thing about this is it is too early to give hot takes because it's a 22-week season now. We don't have to come up with hot takes because it's the season's a tenth done already after the opening round of the season. And it means the likes of, you know, the injured Gilnick and Kellen Knight and Yallop and Kaya Simon aren't going to miss half the season if they miss a month. But we've been going now for about 45 minutes, Lani Johnson. It is early in the morning. You have work. I have work. That is the life of the freelance shit-kicking journalist. Now I have to tag explicit on the podcast description, but no, the S word's fine. Lani, thank you ever so much. You've been incredible in your debut here. As I said, rising star, already put me in the shade. No doubt more of that to come. We're going to get you back throughout the season if you can put up with me, get you on some larger panels as well. So Lani, thank you ever so much for your time. Have you enjoyed yourself?
Thank you, Joey. Thanks for having me.
Indeed it was. So that was Lani Johnson. We were joined by Anna Harrington earlier in the show. My name is Joey Lynch. You have been listening to ESPN's The National Curriculum Podcast. Make sure you subscribe on whatever service you are using. Leave us a 5-star review. Just keep your thoughts to yourself if you want to leave a 1-star review. Tell a friend, share it, be a friend. That's all for us for now. We'll be back next week. But for now, thanks and success.